broker. Or I'm here, I should say, as a knowledge broker, not as a person who has all the answers either, but I'm certainly bringing them up and having a discussion about it. And so thank you for sharing your words that brought us all this information that I can Google and everyone else can too. Mixedness, M-I-X-E-D-N-E.
And you're listening to 90.7 FM WGXC Agra.
Monday, May 2nd, tune in to all sorts of creative community voices on the air at WGXC, including we'll hear all sorts of regional music at 9 a.m. on the WGXC Morning Show, including Columbia County-based poet Karen Schomer and her band Jaded Azarides with legendary bassist Mike Watt, the Brattleboro outfit Wet Tuna with Matt Valentine on guitar, and Hudson Valley cellist Fred Lonberg Home are some of the local sounds we'll hear. 10 a.m. on the Afrosonic Taxi, you'll hear Akwi Adida, Muia Kanuj, and Pedrito Martinez, among others. At noon, it's time for the Deep Three Show with Kronos Quartet, C. Ryder, Pharoah Sanders, and more. 2 p.m., there is brand new music from around the world on the Vital Weekly Show with Ak Young Lee, Nadia Rastamandris, and Katsura Mori. At 3 p.m., Anna Frizz talks Whale Radio. Karen Riley is live from Housatonic in Western Massachusetts with a WGXC afternoon show at 4 p.m. Ted Hamilton talks about the war in Ukraine on the Law and Disorder show at 7 p.m. And Nick and Lisa from Palinville host the Radiant Point show live from Acre, 10 p.m. on 90.7 FM WGXC. On June 17th, three bands come to Tubby's in Kingston. First E, the trio of Jason Sidney Sanford, Thada Zedek, and Gavin McCarthy play rock music. Alive Skull, the renowned 1980s post-punk experimental rock band, is back together and are playing on this show with Upper Wilds, who record for Thrill Jockey and feature multi-instrumentalist songwriter Dan Friel, who's best known for his work in the band Parts and Labor. E, Live Skull, and Upper Wilds play at Tubby's in Kingston June 17th, and you can find out more about this show and many others on the WGXC community calendar online at wgxc.org.
WGXC underwriting support is provided in part by Sun Common, supporting vibrant communities across New York for over 15 years, offering custom solar installations for homes, farms, and businesses. Information at suncommon.com.
WGXC is made possible in part by the generous ongoing support of the Bridge Street Theater in Catskill, New York. WGXC's sustaining supporters are among the station's most dedicated listeners. They care deeply about creative community radio, and their investment helps to sustain WGXC as a public platform for information, experimentation, and engagement in Greene and Columbia counties. You too can become a sustaining supporter by going to wgxc.org/donate and designating an amount of your choosing. Thank you for your support.
WGXC helps you sleep at night and stay awake in the daytime. Whether at work or play, in good times and in bad, no matter the weather, community radio brings you local news, agricultural information, music and sounds, oratory, and radio stews.
90.7 FM, WGXC.
I'm Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Valerie White reports for Porcupine Soup that a majority of Caro Town board members again voted to reopen the town's recycling center on April 20th, but this time they had the necessary three votes. Earlier this month, a majority of the board voted to reopen the recycling center, but two members were absent, so there were not the necessary three votes in favor. This time the vote was 4-1, with only Tim Powers opposed to recycling in Caro. He voted against the measure, he said, because Caro has insufficient surveillance of its own citizens at the park. Garbage strewn at the recycling center in the Angelo Canna Town Park was cited as the reason to stop recycling in Cairo a year ago. Read more about the story at Porcupine Soup. Chloe Callahan reports for the Times Union that the town of Rhinebeck on April 11th did what few towns locally have done. They voted for an affordable housing project. The zoning amendment request by Kearney Realty and Development Group and the Housing Partnership Development Corporation was approved for construction of what will be called the Hamlet at Rhinebeck. Quote, housing prices are going through the roof, unquote, said town supervisor Elizabeth Spinzia. Quote, workforce housing is important for the vibrancy of a community, for maintaining economic balance of residents, unquote. The project, with 18 one-bedroom units, 44 two-bedroom units, and 18 three-bedroom units across four buildings located on a 23-acre site near Route 308 and next to the Wells Manor Senior Housing Development, still needs approval from the planning board. But with real estate prices sky high, forcing local residents to move elsewhere, it was a rare step by a local government to address the Hudson Valley's housing crisis. Of course, construction will take 2 years, so any relief will not be immediate. Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro has said that, quote, housing accessibility is a critical need, unquote, and that the county will, quote, work aggressively to create more workforce housing and opportunity for residents, unquote. Read more about the story in the Times Union. Nick Reisman reports for New York State of Politics that Governor Kathy Hochul announced on April 21st that New Yorkers will be able to qualify for the maximum level of Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits after the state received $232 million in federal funding. Quote, the heart-wrenching prospect of food insecurity is one that no New Yorker should ever have to face, unquote, Governor Hochul said. Quote, by providing the maximum level of food benefits to those in need, we can help struggling households make ends meet and keep food on the table as we continue our economic recovery from the COVID-19 crisis, unquote. The program was previously known as food stamps. Now an additional minimum payment of $95 will go to households at or near the maximum level for benefits, $835 for a household of four people. Quote, these supplemental benefits have played a tremendous role in helping New Yorkers avoid the food insecurity exacerbated by the global pandemic, unquote, said Office of Temporary and Disability Assistance Commissioner Daniel Tites. Quote, in addition to assisting households in need, this funding is providing a welcome boost for local retailers and giving strength to our state's economy as a whole, unquote. Read more about the story at NewYorkStateOfPolitics.com. Read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org.
Ala Abdel-Fattah has not yet been defeated. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. 40-year-old Egyptian political prisoner Ala Abdel-Fattah has embarked on a hunger strike to the death. A leader of the 2011 Arab Spring in Cairo's Tahrir Square that overthrew the longtime U.S.-backed dictator Hosni Mubarak, Ala has been repeatedly targeted for his activism by successive Egyptian governments. He spent 8 of the last 9 years in prison. The dubious crime of broadcasting false news earned him an additional 5-year sentence last December. He is in prison for his ideas and his words, write the editors of You Have Not Yet Been Defeated, the just-published collection of Ala's writings. The editors chose to remain anonymous to avoid the same persecution that Ala has suffered at the hands of the current president, Abdel Fattah el-Sisi. Ala's youngest sister, 28-year-old Egyptian filmmaker and activist Sana Seif, who herself has spent more than 3 years in prison, is now in the United States on a national tour to promote Ala's book and to advocate for his freedom. The Egyptian government is doing all it can to silence Ala Abdel-Fattah, so we rely here on interviews he gave during those fleeting moments over the last decade when he was free. Ala first appeared on the Democracy Now! NewsHour in February of 2011 as the Arab Spring was sweeping across Egypt. Tell us, Ala, it's great to have you with us, a prominent Egyptian blogger, democracy activist. What is happening in front of the presidential palace, one of a number of new places that are being occupied by protesters, like Egyptian state TV as well, and the parliament?
In front of the TV building, it's a big crowd. We can't shut down the TV building because of its shape, and it's heavily barricaded by the army. But what we're trying to do is put pressure on the employees working inside to join us, to revolt and refuse to spread state propaganda.
Alaa's activism during the revolution landed him in jail, that time for 2 months. He spoke on Democracy Now 2 days after his release.
I was in a complete darkness for 5 days. It was very filthy and very crowded. There was 9 of us in a 2x3 meters cell, having no access to water or toilet except 10 minutes per day. So basically they knew they couldn't torture me because of the solidarity and the media attention. So they just made sure to try and use every other measure to put me at discomfort or at a psychological pressure.
Journalist and Democracy Now! Correspondent Sharif Abdelkaddous is also on the book tour. Sharif works with Madamassar, one of the only independent media outlets in Egypt. Speaking on Democracy Now!, he described the al-Sisi regime's increasing reliance on incarceration.
There's this kind of ballooning of the prison population because the government, the regime, doesn't really deal with any of the social, deep social, economic and political problems that are in the country except through incarceration or other forms of oppression.
Case in point is Egyptian TikTok influencer Hanin Hassam, jailed on alleged human trafficking charges. She was instructing women how to earn money by sharing videos on a platform called Likee. She was first sentenced to 10 years, reduced this week to 3 years with a fine of over $10,000, about 3 times Egypt's average annual salary. Alaa comes from an activist family, from his late father, Ahmed Saif el-Islam, a human rights lawyer, to his mother, the mathematician and professor Leila Swaif. After she and her daughters protested in front of the prison where Alaa was being held, her youngest, Sana, was beaten and arrested. She was imprisoned for 1.5 years. Sana said on Democracy Now!,
"What moves me, what keeps us going, is that we as a family want to survive and want to unite in peace. So I don't think they are giving us any choice but to resist them."
Alaa told Sharif Abdelkaddous in a recorded interview in 2014.
"When we talk about the revolution while living it, we're talking about a dream, a wish, something that we're trying to fulfill, something that we're trying to create. But you can only talk about it as being over or not and so on in the distance, while you're looking back. And so when I say defeat, I mean, in the sense of in a battle. But we'll continue to exist, and since we'll continue to exist, there continue to be other struggles and so on. It's not like you have a choice. I mean, an individual might have a choice if they have a way out, but most people don't have a choice. We cannot all immigrate. And it's not like the migrant labor gets a good deal anywhere in the world. So I mean, if what you're trying to do is to achieve a life of dignity and safety and prosperity for yourself and for your loved ones, then you have no choice."
Sana Saif and Sharif Abdelkaddous are touring the United States to raise awareness of Alaa Abdel Fattah's dire plight, now in his 4th week on hunger strike. Meanwhile, Alaa's family managed to obtain UK citizenship for him, as his mother, though Egyptian, was born in London. An immediate intervention by both the Biden administration and the British government would provide the best hope to save this courageous political prisoner. Alaa Abdel Fattah, you have not yet been defeated. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
I'm Tom Rowe in Accra with the WGXC News Update. Go to the WGXC newsroom at wgxc.org for more information about any of these stories. Andrea Macko reports for Porcupine Soup that Greene County elected officials are urging their constituents to actively oppose proposed environmental initiatives that they say will have, quote, disastrous consequences on local communities, unquote. At the April 20th meeting, the county legislature unanimously adopted a resolution detailing the alleged adverse impacts on residents and businesses that lawmakers say will occur under the New York State Climate Leadership and Community Protection Act. The CLCPA is one of the most ambitious climate laws in the world, celebrated by environmental groups as an important step forward in addressing global climate change. Under the Act, the New York State Climate Action Council is tasked with developing a draft plan to serve as an initial framework for how the state will reduce greenhouse gas emissions and achieve net zero emissions, increase renewable energy usage, and ensure climate justice. The plan was released in December, and public comment will be accepted until June 10th. Quote, the Greene County Legislature supports prudent action on energy efficiency, unquote, said Republican Legislative Chair Patrick Linger. Quote, however, the mandates outlined by the Climate Action Council will take us down a narrow, expensive, and risky path centered on limiting homeowner choice, preventing research and innovation, and electrifying everything, unquote, he said. Many others are not against the state's proposed plan. Representatives of the Sierra Club and Catskill Mountain Keeper both fully support the legislation, for instance. County lawmakers have directed the County Planning Office to submit the concerns and comments contained in the resolution adopted last week, as well as an accompanying climate report prepared for Greene, Delaware, and Schoharie counties to the New York State Climate Action Council. The legislature also directed the County Planning, Public Works, and Emergency Services departments to further review the draft scoping plan and provide comments as appropriate. Read more about the story at porcupinesoup.com. Shayla Colin is reporting for the Times-Union that Rensselaer Mayor Michael Stommel has for years retained control of a building that used to house the Rensselaer Volunteer Ambulance Service. However, the space is frequently rented for private events with little accountability for its business dealings and finances. Stommel said he is a member of the group's now inactive board, but refused to name any other members. He also confirmed that the nonprofit forfeited its certification last year, but continues to rent out the building at 901 3rd Street for parties and gatherings. That ongoing use has raised questions about the squad's finances and the lack of publicly available business records. Records on file with the State Attorney General's Charities Bureau also lack details of the squad's business dealings, and Stammel is the only contact listed on the group's website. A nearby resident has dubbed the 3rd Street building's status as an ambulance company-turned-party venue and, quote, open secret, unquote. The mayor said he has been on the board for 15 years and that the building remains the property of the ambulance squad board. After failing to identify the others involved, he said the board is, quote, reorganizing, unquote, and, quote, fluid, unquote. Stammel also claims to be the building's caretaker. Quote, anybody who wants information out in the neighborhood, they know how to talk to me, unquote, he said. Chris Killahoon, who lives nearby, said the rentals are, quote, consistent, unquote, and that the building was, quote, dead, unquote, before Stammel took office as mayor at the beginning of 2020. Quote, he rents that place out, unquote, Killahoon said, questioning where the funds go. Quote, maybe he's got a big stash of money there, who knows, unquote, he said. An anonymous former ambulance squad volunteer said that in 2014, a couple of years after a fire occurred in the building, Stammel and the organization's treasurer locked everyone out. Rensselaer City Council President John DeFrancesco says Stammel treats the building like his clubhouse. Quote, somehow it ends up being he's one of the last survivors and the building really should be sold and any money split amongst everyone, but he keeps it under his wing and uses it to his advantage, unquote, he said. Read more about this story in the Times Union. Bill Williams reports for Columbia Green Media that the destructive southern pine beetle that kills pine trees continues to move north and was recently found in Columbia County. Department of Environmental Conservation spokesperson Lori Severinos said the destructive pests have been discovered in Taconic State Park, as well as Minnewaska State Park Preserve, Shinumuk Mountain State Park, and Hudson Highlands. They were found further north than previously documented and in greater numbers, suggesting their range is expanding and populations are on the rise, DEC Commissioner Basil Sago said. Southern pine beetle poses a significant threat to the state's pine forests, specifically pitch pine forests, such as those found in the Albany Pine Bush and Minnewaska State Park Preserve, Sago said. Three infested pines at Taconic State Park were found near Sunset Rock during joint survey efforts and were subsequently removed and destroyed. Native to the southeastern United States, the southern pine beetle was first discovered infesting pitch pines on Long Island in 2014. Since then, it has killed hundreds of thousands of trees on Long Island alone. The insect attacks primarily pitch pine and red pine, but will also attack additional trees when outbreaks occur, Severino said. The DEC encourages the public to report any signs of southern pine beetles encountered in pine forests by emailing photographs and location information to foresthealth@dec.ny.gov. The signs of an infestation include discolored needles, popcorn-sized clumps of resin anywhere along the trunk, tiny holes in the bark, and in a scattershot pattern and S-shaped galleries under the bark, Severino said. Read more about this story at HudsonValley360.com and read more about any of these stories in the WGXC newsroom, WGXC.org. This is Tom Rowe in Acre with the WGXC Renewable Weather Report from your solar-powered radio station. Sunday, the National Weather Service in Albany predicts a partly sunny day with a high of 58 with a southeast wind 3 to 6 miles per hour. And that sustains Sunday night with a low around 42 and cloudy skies. Monday should be partly sunny again with a high of 62 and a stronger southeast wind from 5 to 8 miles per hour. Then there's a 40% chance of showers on Monday night, mainly after 2 a.m., with cloudy skies and a low around 46, and a south wind blowing 7 to 9 miles per hour. Tuesday, again, there is a chance of showers, a 50% chance, with cloudy skies, a high near 60, and a chance of showers Tuesday night, again, with cloudy skies and a low around 41. You're listening to the radio, WGXC 90.7 FM, Acre, Catskill, Hudson, solar radio powered for open ears. Here is this week's Hudson Valley Congressional Report from WGXC from Philip Grant and myself, Tom Rowe, tracking the votes, statements, positions, and campaigns of the representatives of the Hudson Valley in Congress and the candidates who want to replace them. Current Democrat Representatives Antonio Delgado, Paul Tonko, and Sean Maloney vote with the positions of President Joe Biden 100% of the time, according to the 538.com website. Republican Elise Stefanik voted with Biden's positions 18% of the time.
Two political prognosticators moved the re-election of Democrat Antonio Delgado to the 19th congressional district from likely Democrat to leans Democrat on April 20th. Both Larry Sabato's Crystal Ball and the Cook Political Report downgraded Delgado's chances of beating Republican Mark Molinaro, currently the Dutchess County executive, in November's election. Both analysts said the move was because of a national wave moving towards Republicans and not about the specifics of the Delgado-Molinaro campaigns. Sabato's Crystal Ball website said about the five Democrats that were moving from likely winners to leaning toward predicting a win, and I quote, "In a Republican wave scenario, these are the kinds of districts that could get swept up. Republicans appear to have credible recruits in these districts that are raising enough money to be competitive," end quote. Republican National Congressional Committee spokesperson Samantha Bullock crowed about the political predictions. She said, and I quote, "Everyone can see the writing on the wall, and this will be Antonio Delgado's last term in Congress," end quote. Mid-Hudson News reports that Dutchess County Executive Mark Molinaro delivered his 2022 State of the County Address on April 20th in Pine Plains, with eyes from throughout New York's 19th Congressional District looking in. Molinaro spoke about a Dutchess County future he hopes not to be a part of, as he is currently the Republican candidate for Congress, hoping to replace Democrat Antonio Delgado. Molinaro said, and I quote, "Today we are poised for more growth and prosperity because of our decade-long commitment to smart, fiscally conservative, and compassionate government. To continue along this path, we must redouble our efforts to keep Dutchess County safe and affordable, creating opportunities and optimism for every county resident," end quote. He spoke about expanding mental health services, tackling the opioid crisis, funding first responders, and housing needs in the community. Molinaro previously backed off his plan to give $12.5 million in taxpayer money for a minor league baseball stadium, switching $9.5 million of the stadium money for housing needs. Molinaro plans three public forums to give residents a chance to address the needs of the community. The first is at 12:30 p.m. May 3rd at the Office for the Aging, Tri-Town Senior Friendship Center in Pleasant Valley. The second is at 5:30 p.m. May 10th at the Red Hook Community Center, and the last is at 5:30 p.m. May 17th at the American Legion Post 427 in Wappingers Falls. Read more about this story at Mid-Hudson News. Michelle Del Rey reports in the Times Union that Republican candidate Liz Joy raised $146,575 from individuals during the first quarter, while incumbent Democrat Paul Tonko raised just $84,637. Since the beginning of 2021, Joy has raised $457,185 in individual donations, while Tonko raised $409,110. A statement provided by Joy's campaign read, and I quote, "Our campaign continues to beat expectations and raise more money each quarter. We outraised Tonko again in individual contributions for the third quarter in a row, which shows the level of support we have from people who live and work in the 20th district," end quote. The Republican Joy lost to the Democrat Tonko by a 62% to 38% margin. Redistricting has made the district slightly better for a Republican, but it is still considered a safe seat for Democrats. Tonko's campaign did not comment for the story. And you can read more about this story in the Times Union.
Inside Radio reports that in the federal budget just passed by Congress, with votes four locally from Democrats Antonio Delgado, Paul Tonko, and Sean Maloney, and a no vote from Republican Elise Stefanik, that includes $16 million extra this year for the Federal Communications Commission. That's a 4.3% increase from the current year's $374 million FCC budget. The plan is to hire 15 full-time new employees to address pirate radio enforcement, mainly because of a 2020 law passed by Congress that raised potential pirate radio fines to $2 million. That bill, sponsored by Paul Tonko, was criticized at the time for ridiculous cartoon fines with no backing, as Congress had repeatedly defunded the FCC's Enforcement Bureau. Tonko received $7,000 during the 2016 campaign from the National Association of Broadcasters, who support larger fines for pirate radio operators. There has not been a major report of any pirate radio stations in the Hudson Valley in many years. President Joe Biden asked for an increase of $5 million for the Enforcement Bureau to hire the 15 new employees in the new budget. This is Tom Rowe with Wave Farm with the WGXC Radio News, daily update on what's going on in broadcast news. Adi Robertson reports for The Verge that the Russian invasion of Ukraine has been fought with tanks, planes, ships, and humans, and also with radio waves. There's a battle of information over the internet, television, and radio. And while the U.S. has banned selling almost anything to Russia, a few radio-related products are now allowed for export to Russia to help in the information war. The U.S. Department of the Treasury is exempting telecommunications services from the sanctions against Russia. Advocacy groups for anti-war protesters inside Russia predicted that blocking internet services would cut off Russian activists' access to the outside world. So the Department of the Treasury is allowing, quote, services, software, hardware, or technology incident to the exchange of communications over the internet, such as instant messaging, video conferencing, chat and email, social networking, sharing of photos, movies and documents, web browsing, blogging, web hosting, and domain name registration services, unquote. Access Now, one of the groups advocating for Russian activists, applauded the decision. Quote, U.S. internet communication technologies are key for human rights defenders and independent media to report on and fight Russian and Belarusian governments' aggression in Ukraine, unquote, said the group's tech legal counsel, Natalia Krapvia. Internet backbone providers Lumen and Cogent and MailChimp operator Intuit ended their service in Russia before the sanctions were approved. Slack only blocked the access from Russia after the sanctions hit. The Ukraine government has asked for more than it has gotten so far. Ukraine wanted DNS overseer ICANN to revoke Russia's access to the domain name system, but was turned down. ICANN said a revocation, blocking Russia from the rest of the world, could have, quote, devastating and permanent effects on the trust and utility of this global system, unquote. The Russian government has not been acting in kind, as they have been blocking major global services such as Facebook and Instagram in a wide-ranging crackdown on free speech of any kind. Read more about this story at The Verge. Ella Curris reports for Radio World that the Communications Infrastructure Contractors Association, which is the union for broadcast tower climbers, and Storybuilt Media are releasing a feature-length documentary called Vertical Freedom about six communications infrastructure workers in the United States. Kai Nguyen is featured in the film and said he had no experience before joining the industry. Quote, I started as a climber and then just kept working my way up, unquote, he said. Quote, then I became foreman and began project managing. I'm one of those types of guys where if you want it done a certain way, you have to be with them, showing them, leading by example. So I'm climbing every day, unquote. In 2012, a PBS Frontline documentary called Cell Tower Deaths reported that in the previous decade, nearly 100 climbers were killed on radio, TV, and cell towers, a rate that is about 10 times the average for construction workers. The latest death was in December of Michael Vasquez, working for Broken Arrow Communications, where he fell from a communications tower in Arlington, Washington. This industry documentary does not focus on those deaths and accidents,